on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. We begin today with a new report from the Able Foundation, which says efforts in Maryland to restore the Chesapeake Bay are being threatened by state spending priorities and inadequate curbs on the biggest source of pollution, agriculture. Our senior producer, Rob Sivak, takes a closer look. And the Single Carrot Theater has been an anchor on Baltimore's thespian landscape for almost 10 years. I'll talk with the company's managing director and artistic director about their current production, the thriving theater scene in Charm City, and what the company is doing to address inequality. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews a musical that combines Americana and the holiday spirit, and Zoe Washington Chef has fashion gift ideas for your favorite people. Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these national headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. A report released last week by the Able Foundation called The Chesapeake Bay and Agricultural Pollution concludes that efforts in Maryland to restore the pollution-damaged watershed are being slowed by inadequate curbs on the biggest source of that pollution, which is agriculture. Here's Maryland Morning senior producer Rob Sivak with more on the story.
Thanks, Tom. With me this morning are three distinguished guests with unique perspectives on agriculture's relationship with the Chesapeake. Here in the studio, Rona Cabell, a veteran environmental journalist and a WYPR contributor who now writes for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and Dr. Robert Summers, the former Maryland Secretary of the Environment who works today as senior research scientist with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. And with us on the phone from Annapolis is Lynn Hoot, the executive director of the Maryland Grain Producers Association, which represents the interests of more than 400 diversified grain farmers, large and small, from western Maryland to the eastern shore. Let me begin with a question to all of you. Maryland and five other states, D.C. and the federal government, have been at the Chesapeake Bay restoration effort for more than 30 years now. Yet today there seem to be very contradictory assessments of how well the bay is and its 64,000 square miles of watershed are actually doing. So let me ask each of you, do you believe the condition of the Chesapeake in terms of water quality and biological health is improving, or is it still in crisis, still facing serious pollution threats? Start with you, Lynn Hoot.
Well, I think we're all disappointed with the progress to date. I think there are some signs of improvement, but they're a lot smaller than we'd all hoped for. And a lot of effort from the agricultural community has gone into Chesapeake Bay cleanup. So I would suggest we're disappointed but optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Summers?
Well, certainly if you look at the data, there have been improvements in pollution levels coming into the bay, lowering of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment. But recently, we've seen that the rate of improvement has slowed and, in fact, in some areas, reversed. So I think the way Lynn portrayed it, I would agree with. We are very optimistic, but it's also been a very difficult effort, and we clearly need to do more, given that we're seeing this reversal, or at least slowing in the improvement.
Mm-hmm. Rona?
I think the 1972 Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act have helped immensely in cleaning up a lot of the pollution that used to, frankly, choke Baltimore and the areas around Baltimore in the 70s and 80s. I think we've made tremendous improvement in those areas, but the improvement is eroded by a few factors, including that we keep bringing more people into the watershed and more people keep paving over more surfaces. And so when we make progress, we're often sort of a one step forward, two steps back kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Rona Cabell, the report does suggest that Maryland farmers, who along with other farmers in the region, are the largest single contributors, the largest source of the pollution that goes into the watershed. that they're not being held to sufficient account for their role in continuing to pollute. Is that the central theme of the report?
Well, I think the central theme of the report is ways that we can move forward to make it better. As I mentioned before, the 1972 Clean Water Act regulated sewage treatment plants and the Clean Air Act regulated power plants. And we've seen tremendous improvement on both of those fronts with those major pollutants. We've come a really long way with sewage treatment, and I would say we've come a really long way with air pollution. But the farms are not regulated in the same way. And in part, that's because we're talking about large sort of municipal institutions versus individual operators who have their own land. So I think the point of the report, and one of the reasons that I wanted to be involved in it, was to try to see if there were other solutions that we could find from other states or within our own network here that we could sort of improve the way this is handled, not to take a sector and pick on it and blame it, but to say to that sector, okay, how can we do this better?
Are there specific recommendations that you can describe here briefly that farmers can embrace or implement on their farms that they're not doing now?
Well, one of the recommendations that we have is for verification and auditing. So farmers get some funds from the federal government, and they put some of their own funds in to put in things like cover crops and buffers. And these are practices that you put on the land to help absorb nitrogen and phosphorus and keep it out of the waterways. We have a very good success rate in Maryland with farmers applying for these programs and putting these practices in. But what we're not doing that well is checking to make sure that these practices are being implemented properly. Our state agencies are always low on inspectors, and we don't inspect every farm. In fact, we don't inspect most farms to make sure that the practices are working properly and that we are monitoring so that we know that if we say that this practice is going to reduce the nitrogen by 50% and the phosphorus by 65%, that we're monitoring and we know that we're actually getting that reduction. So at the moment, we don't have that information.
Lynn Hoot, can I ask for your comments on that particular dimension of the report? I mean, would Maryland farmers be willing to accept a higher level of verification than they now have to deal with?
Well, I think there is a lot of support for Maryland's program as it's being conducted now. EPA just did a review of all six states on their animal agricultural program assessment. It was released in August 31st. Their comment about Maryland's was that it was robust and well implemented, and in fact, they have in there showing that in fiscal year 14, 13.5% of all regulated farms, which is anybody with an income of over $2,500 or 8 animal units, they inspected 13.5%, and they documented everything they found on those farms. And they issued $21,000 in fines for those farmers who were not in compliance with the nutrient management law. So I think the verification is there within the program. I think EPA, which I consider to be a third-party verifier, has reviewed the program that exists today. And I'm not suggesting you that there's not improvements, but over the last decade, the nutrient management law that passed in 98 has added incorporation of manure and litter, mandatory buffers, mandatory animal exclusion, limited the application of manure from November through March, and required a full nitrate test on all nitrogen on small grains. And then last year we added the phosphorus management tool, which from day one limited how much phosphorus could be put on high phosphorus soil. So I sort of feel as if this report isn't reflective of what's really happening today.
Dr. Summers?
Well, I would respectfully disagree. I do agree that Maryland has the strongest agricultural program of any of the states, but I think that there are a lot of details involved in reviewing a nutrient management plan, ensuring that stream buffers and cover crops and so forth are being properly applied and properly maintained. So there definitely is a need for improved verification. And this was recognized by the EPA, and they've spent a lot of time developing a new verification protocol, which each of the states is required to implement beginning now. And this report, I believe, is timely in that we need to make sure that this new EPA verification protocol is actually fully implemented so that we can be sure that these things are happening. There's also a provision of the U.S. federal farm bill that prohibits the release of information about a specific farm with respect to whether or not a particular practice has been implemented. And this is a barrier to being able to verify that these things are actually being done properly and working. And I'm not blaming the farmers. I'm saying that many farmers are very good and they do this. But in order to have the same level of confidence that an agricultural operation is following its practices as we do for a sewage treatment plant or some other regulated entity under the Clean Water Act, we need to have the ability to look at these individual practices.
And it's my understanding that MDA, Maryland Department of Agriculture, is party to those restrictions on access and has a relationship with USDA and is working through the soil conservation districts to verify those practices.
But Lynn Hood, wouldn't greater transparency, wouldn't the ability for the public to know which farms are succeeding and which farms are failing be helpful in reassuring people that the best practices are actually being implemented to save the bay?
We want all farmers to be achieving the necessary requirements to meet the goal, and our soil conservation districts will be working with them to do that, and so will the Department of Agriculture through the nutrient management program. And I understand that EPA has actually approved the verification process, where 10% of the practices will be approved every year. And any BMP has to be inspected initially before it can go into the Bay model. So I think that the new protocols, agriculture is fine with. You know, and we understand that there is a need to make sure the practices are there. The large majority of farmers are doing everything they can and doing a lot more and using a lot of their own money to do it.
I have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thanks to Rona Cabell, a staff writer with the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and Dr. Robert Summers, the former Maryland Secretary of the Environment, two of the four authors of the Able Foundation report, The Chesapeake Bay and Agricultural Pollution. And thanks also to Lynn Hoot, the Executive Director of the Maryland Grain Producers Association. We've got links to the report and all our guests on our website, wypr.org/program/Maryland Morning. I'm producer Rob Sivak. There's more coming up later this hour, so stay with us. Now, here's Nathan.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at wypr.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. And now a look at the local theater scene. It's Monday. That means that theater critic Jaywin Russick will be here shortly with her weekly theater review. This week she shares her thoughts about the gifts of the Magi at the Maryland Ensemble Theater down in Frederick. But first, a conversation with some folks at the Single Carrot Theater here in Baltimore. Their latest production is called The Year of the Rooster, a story about the seedy world of cockfighting. Alix Fenhagen is the managing director of Single Carrot Theater, and Genevieve DeMahi is a founding member and the artistic director. They join me in the studio. Good morning. Good to see you guys.
Hi. Good morning.
Happy holidays. So Genevieve, this is a touching story about a boy and his rooster. Tell us a little bit about Gil and Odie.
So the play is a rip-roaring comedy about a guy named Gil who's down on his luck and kind of in a rut in his life, and he searches on a quest to achieve fame and glory through cockfighting.
don't we all, at one time or another in our lives, right?
Yeah.
So, Alix, this is based on the Odysseus myth?
Very, very loosely, yeah.
Refresh my memory about what the Odysseus myth is.
Well, the Odysseus myth is Odysseus gets caught at the war and spends years and years trying to get home to his wife, Penelope. It really very, very loosely touches on some of the story around the Cyclops. And Odysseus defeating the Cyclops. Gil, who is a fast food worker and the protagonist in the story, has one eye, kind of like the Cyclops. And Odie is the name of his rooster, short for Odysseus. So there's some loose mm-hmm. tie-ins there.
With all theater, the question is, you know, when you say the play is about this guy and his rooster, Genevieve, what's it really about? What are the themes here?
I think it's really about the American dream and the failing of the American dream. You know, the characters in the play live in Oklahoma in a somewhat rural, economically depressed area. And they're really, Gil is really investing everything into this kind of lottery shot of fame through cockfighting. And I think there are other characters in the play who are also have those positions where they're really shooting. They have this pie in the sky goal that they're going for. And a lot of it centers around, I think, the economic circumstances of their area. For example, Gil's mom is collecting disability and she's at home and she's nostalgic for the days of her youth when she was kind of this beauty queen. And Gil's coworker, Philippa, who's the manager of the McDonald's, has this goal of becoming the owner of all of the McDonald's chains in the world and going to Walt Disney World. And so they all have these dreams.
In that order, right?
Yeah, they all have these big dreams that they're going for and are limited by their economic realities.
So, Alix, when you all, as a company, choose the repertoire that you're going to do for a particular season, is the fact that there are so many, direct parallels, direct resonances with what's going on in the economy of the United States of America, with the bifurcation of the very, very wealthy and the middle class that is quickly vanishing? I mean, is the fact that there are some political resonances of this play, was that one of the reasons that you all chose it?
Absolutely. I think one of the questions that we always ask during season planning is, what's the purpose of showing this play and why now? Why is it important that people see this play? If the answer is it's not, chances are Single Carrot probably doesn't want to do it at that time. So I think the tie-ins to what's going on in the world economically definitely resonated with us. It's also really funny. I think the ability of theater to explore deep and important issues through a lens of humor is something that Single Carrot that appeals to us.
Alix Fenhegan, she is the managing director of the Single Carrot Theater. Genevieve DeMahi is a founding member and the current artistic director. So Genevieve, you guys read a lot of scripts. I mean, you are constantly, checking out the landscape of what's available out there mm-hmm. for you to do. And you choose, what is it, 4 or 5 plays a season? I've lost track. How many do you usually do in a given year?
Right now, we're doing 4 main productions a season with other projects and limited engagements throughout the year.
Of those, of the multitude, hundreds of scripts that you read, you come down to 4. What are the general criteria, the animating principles behind how you choose a season?
We definitely look for plays that align with our mission to produce new and socially significant work, work that we think will be innovative to the theater scene. And one of the other priorities is vibrant theatrical experiences. So really picking plays that we think will enhance the audience experience.
Does Single Carrot then, look to fill a particular niche, in the Baltimore theater scene, which since you all have come to town has, quadrupled or something. I mean, it's increased exponentially. But I think, for example, the fact that Center Stage would not shy away from doing a Shakespeare play and the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company wouldn't shy away from doing a non-Shakespeare play is, you do a lot of contemporary work. Do you do only contemporary work? And is that not only part of your mission, but is that something you see as a thing that you guys can do that other folks aren't going to be looking at?
It's something that we're looking at right now. We're sort of hitting up on our 10-year anniversary next year, which is really exciting. And in doing that, we're trying to figure out, now that there is so much theater going on in Baltimore, where we fit and what sort of work is unique to us. I think this year we are exclusively doing new work, two new plays and then two completely original plays, one by the company and one by a playwright named Ben Hoover. And
we should say that the Year of the Rooster is the regional premiere of this particular
absolutely,
work.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so that's very exciting for us. If we were to do Shakespeare, and we have in the past, it's our version of Shakespeare. So I think we're trying to figure out this year exactly what that niche is. I would say it's new work for sure is a part of it. International work has been a part of it in the past. And certainly if classics and traditional work stay a part of it, which they have been, it's always our take on it.
You guys have been here almost 10 years. You were one of the founding group that came from Colorado. You chose Baltimore. How would you describe, summarize, the changes that you've seen in the theater itself and in the theater scene in these last almost 10 years?
There's always been an underground theater presence, and I think Baltimore in general has really this, like, very underground arts culture that's always existed. And since we came on the scene, we've been really excited to see a ton of new theater companies pop up. And I think there's really been this, like, revolution of theater companies and this renaissance of theater companies, which has happened in a few other mid-sized cities as well. It's a national trend. Cities like Denver and Austin and a lot of other mid-sized cities have had this surge of these small theater companies that are popping up and doing exciting things. And for me, I think, and in Baltimore as well, it's really this trend toward community-based relationships that, yes, there are big theaters and you can see actors that come from New York and other places, but really this kind of veering back towards the local and having relationships with the artists that the community has relationships with the artists that are working in shows and that people are creating shows that are more linked to their local community. And I see that a lot in a lot of the theaters that have come up. Baltimore is a place where people have the space to take risks, and there's an environment of people who embrace the eccentric. I think of this kind of new renaissance of theater companies, you know, we were at the forefront of that and at the forefront of being in Station North as it was blossoming.
And Alex, I think the case can be made that Single Carrot was a great instigator, a great model and paradigm for other companies with the success that they had. You know, when I started talking to you guys almost 10 years ago, Genevieve, one of the emphases was going to be to bring particularly younger people into the theater. Because you go to Center Stage, you go to Everyman, I mean, and Vinnie Lancisi at Everyman and Kwame Kwayarma at Center Stage would be the first to admit that the audiences tend to be older. They're certainly older for me with the Choral Arts Society. We're all looking for that ever elusive, you know, younger demographic, as it were. You guys are young people. The core of your company are young people. How have you addressed that, and how do you think that's going in terms of involving them?
It's going pretty well. I mean, we still tend to have an audience that skews younger than the larger theaters in Baltimore. I think one of the ways is that it becomes a social experience. We have social time in the lobby after the show where the actors will come out and talk to people or the director will be there. Everyone who works front of house is somehow involved with the theater, whether it's myself at the box office or Genevieve or a board member. So I think that community part is appealing and that social part is appealing. We've also been really adamant about continuing our education program and growing our education program. So right now we have a year-long partnership with Margaret Brent where we're providing all of their...
That's a school.
Exactly.
And the elementary school.
In mm-hmm. Remington, where we're providing all of their arts education or all of their theater education for arts integrated learning. And we have this revamped fellowship program. So we have three amazing new fellows who are just out of college or maybe a couple years out. The goal of them working with us for a season to grow them into professional artists. And so I think skewing a lot of our programming and our educational programming to youth and to young artists definitely helps mm-hmm. that as well.
And Genevieve, I think there is a particular connection to the community that you have. You didn't have it the first couple of years because nobody knew who you were, but once people started to get to know you, you're of the community. How do you think that has changed? And I've asked this of other people. I'm interested in people's responses. Since what happened on the 27th of April in our city, how has that changed your understanding of your obligation as an arts organization in this community?
So we've been talking about that a lot and working to create programming that addresses those issues in Baltimore. We had the fortunate circumstance of not long after the uprising, a Canadian theater company reached out to us, and they're Toronto-based. They're called Playing with Crayons, and they were here for the DC Black Theater Festival, and they wanted to perform their show in Baltimore as well. And it centers around a community center that's closing, and the people who frequent that center. I'd say it's really about the Black male experience. And so they reached out to us wanting to do a show at Single Carrot, and fortunately, we were able to find one night. We were in the middle of running a show, but we were able to find one night where they could come in and do that show. That plus other things that we have in the works that we're thinking about is really finding ways to broaden our community connectivity and make sure that there are opportunities for Black artists to share their voice and their experience. We're working on hopefully a project next year that's in the planning phases in collaboration with a Hungarian theater company, but it involves community storytelling and working with neighborhoods to share those stories. So we're really excited about that project, and we're hoping that we're reaching out to some other artists to come in and perform in our space.
Mm-hmm. So, Alix, 10 years ago, I think it was hard for Genevieve and the co-founders of the theater to imagine being in this beautiful theater on Howard Street, connected at the hip to a very good restaurant, Parts and Labor. As you look ahead 5 years from now, where do you think Single Carrot will be? What will be happening there that perhaps isn't happening there now?
Well, I'm hoping, the plan is to still be in this beautiful theater, to find a way to activate it for the community, for it really to be a platform. So Genevieve mentioned, making it a space where other artists can present their work. And we'd love to find a way to do more of that as well as our own programming. We'd love to see more classes going on. We have right now community workshops or drop-in educational workshops on Saturday mornings. Our next one's on the 19th, and it's puppet making for children. And we'd love to have more of those things all the time. I think we'd really love the theater to be a hub for theatrical innovation moving forward, and that being a place where new work is created, a place where by both us and by artists who come to create work on their own and artists who come to create work with us.
Well, big plans, and it's a pretty place to do it. All right, so break a leg for the rest of the run of this show, and thanks you guys for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Alix Fenhagen is the managing director of the Single Carrot Theater here in Baltimore. Genevieve DeMahie is the artistic director. The Year of the Rooster is at Single Carrot until January 10th. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. More theater just ahead here on the program. Stay with us. The Maryland Ensemble Theater is presenting a musical called The Gifts of the Magi. Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick headed to Frederick last week to see it. Here's her review.
A newsboy sings about creating Christmas on a stage in his opening number in The Gifts of the Magi. That's the feeling Maryland Ensemble Theater's production evokes. It's a modest Christmas, but that's the only approach that would be appropriate for this small-scale, musical adaptation of O. Henry's most famous story. The story tells of a young husband and wife struggling to make ends meet in early 20th century New York. Jim and Della are determined to buy each other Christmas presents, despite financial duress. And, of course, in true O. Henry fashion, the story has a surprise ending. The musical's creators, Mark St. Germain and Randy Kortz, also weave in a second O. Henry story. The Cop and the Anthem is an account of a homeless man named Soapy Smith. Soapy's idea of a Christmas present is getting arrested so that he can enjoy what he calls his annual holiday, a few months in a warm jail cell with 3 squares a day. St. Germain and Kortz introduced 2 devices to transfer O. Henry's fiction to the stage. The first is an homage to playwright Thornton Wilder, a stage manager type character. In this case, he's the newsboy narrator named Willie Porter, after the author. O. Henry was the pen name of William Sidney Porter. Daniel Valentin Morales gives an affable portrayal of this newsboy, a character with the ability to freeze a scene and, with a snap of his fingers, bring it back to life. The second added device is a 2-member chorus, identified as The City. Jeanine Evans and Laura K. Stark play everything from a pair of caroling matrons to waiters, a butcher, a cop, and shop clerks. In the song Greed, they each shove Jim and Della out of their stores on Christmas Eve.
We will gladly pinch your pockets one by one. A holiday's a lot of fun.
Have a tea, the crying, and the show, and a flash of a little bit of green.
This musical magi also takes some liberties with O. Henry. In the original title story, Jim is underemployed, barely scraping by. Here, he's out of work completely. We also learn the backstory of Jim and Della's marriage. They were childhood sweethearts. In one especially tender scene, Della, played by Shelley Hertzstetter, gives Jim, played by Eric Jones, a tiny salvaged Christmas tree potted in a coffee can.
Close your eyes.
Are you sneaking a man out the door?
All right, now open them when I count to three. One.
Two.
I know what comes after one. Two. Three.
What is it?
Our Christmas tree. I found it on Park Avenue, near 8th, in the gutter.
I first saw this gentle 1984 O. Henry musical a dozen years ago at Olney Theater Center. I remember thinking at the time that it could make, pardon the pun, an evergreen Christmas treat, a pleasant stocking stuffer, as opposed to Santa's usual overstuffed bag of glitzy productions. The show is a lovely combination of Americana and true Christmas spirit, with its period setting and understated message about gifts from the heart instead of from the pocketbook. Director Suzanne Beale's actors aren't uniformly strong singers. And, given the outcome of O. Henry's title story, there's a significant error with Della's eventual hairstyle. But Julie Herber has created some nifty choreography. For example, in a shopping scene, four actors move as if they're going through a revolving door. And Eric Jones's Jim and Ray Hatch's Soapy do a jaunty dance in an amusing number called Bum Luck. The Gifts of the Magi isn't the most polished or sophisticated work I've seen at Maryland Ensemble Theater, but it's charming and tuneful. And, even more than the roasted chestnuts sold outside the glittering holiday shops in Frederick, the Gifts of the Magi will warm the cockles.
I can't give you anything but love, baby.
The Gifts of the Magi is at the Maryland Ensemble Theater in Frederick until January 3rd. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be back next week with her thoughts about the new show at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore, outside Mullingar. Coming up after a news break, Zoe Washington Chef with some fashion gift ideas. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. With the holiday season in full swing, people who think about fashion have the challenge of staying warm and looking their best for all those festive holiday parties. And how about that perfect fashion gift everybody needs to find? Zoe Washington Chef is here with some ideas for meeting these seasonal challenges. Zoe's a regular contributor here on Maryland Morning. She's a fashion editor and creative consultant for Essence and Elle magazines, as well as other leading publications. And she's the founder of Little Bird, a fashion consulting company focusing on the teen market. Hey, Zoe, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So now you're Zoe Washington Chef.
I'm
That's
married.
Pretty exciting.
I'm a Sadie married lady.
A Sadie married lady. Well, terrific. I recommend it highly.
Thank you.
I'm coming up on 30 years, and I think it's a good idea. So we got sort of like three things to talk about. We got these, like maybe some warm coats to talk about, what to wear under those coats, and then speaking of under, what do we put under the tree?
Totally.
So what's the deal with coats this year? Anything new on the horizon?
Well, you got to wear them because it's cold.
It's cold.
It's cold. You know, one thing about coats, every season there's like a silhouette that's du jour. And this season it's all about a puffer coat and it's all about a shearling coat.
A puffer coat.
And that's great.
I'm thinking like Michelin tire thing.
That is exactly what it is. And that's kind of great because it sometimes during the fall or winter, designers will be talking about coat silhouettes, and it's completely impractical. It'll be like, oh, coats are really great when they're cut just below the chest or something stupid where you're still cold. And so this is great because everybody loves to stay warm during the winter. So having really expertly cut, sort of down-filled, Michelin-styled, as you said, coats are really wonderful for fall.
That's good. So, it's, I mean, before those used to be sort of like parkas.
Yes. You know, and they still kind of are. Uh-huh. But what you've seen is that designers and sort of trickle-down designers, the sort of contemporary market, have reworked them so they're a lot more flattering and a lot more streamlined. Mm-hmm. So think of sort of Norma Kamali, Uniqlo, Gap, Old Navy. They all have a version of this puffer coat. And everybody has shearling. Every single person has shearling.
Explain to me what a shearling is.
So shearling, it's sort of like a suede outside, and then it looks like a sort of Mongolian lamb fur on the inside. And that can it can take different incarnations, but it's usually tan on the outside, brown on the outside, and light tan on the inside. Mm-hmm. And that's great because, again, it's a good warm weather staple. It's something that no matter what season it is, I mean, what year it is, that will always be in style. Mm-hmm. So it's good to make a nice investment, and if you want to go cruelty-free, there's tons of options.
Yeah, cool. Now, when you put something under that coat, you know, to go to the holiday party, I mean, have holiday party fashions really changed that much over the years? It doesn't seem to me that they do.
I mean, it's always about, oh, this is my sequin top or my sequin skirt or my beaded this or my beaded that for women. And then for men, it's like, welcome to my cashmere sweater, which, listen, I am all about and I totally stand behind. So there's nothing revolutionary about holiday dressing, but I will say that things are getting a little bit more conservative, which is kind of great. So you're seeing a lot of midi-length skirts, and it's all about making a statement. So if you do something with a beading or embellishment, that's always huge. But if you choose to go without embellishment, that's also recommended. And so what you do is you do like a bright, bold color, which is really big for winter, or you do a big splash of white and black in the middle. So graphic patterns are really big. So you don't necessarily have to be beaded in order to stay fabulous.
Mm-hmm, cool. Any particular color that's the color for 2015?
Well, we just had the Pantone Color of the Year come out for 2016, and they're both pastel-oriented. And that's kind of funny because I think that for the winter, the third coat that I would say, other than shearling and the puffer coat, is really a sort of light pastel coat. So a light pink or a light purple, that's really huge. So that's also huge for holiday dressing.
All right. How about the perfect holiday fashion gift? What are people given this year?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of everything because you don't want to miss the mark. And it's deeply personal. I think the best gift ever is a gift card. But if you're going to go fashion-oriented...
I mean, it really is. Because otherwise, you know, you run the big risk of somebody having to go back to the store and just return it.
Oh, completely. And retailers are forecasting that gift card... This is the biggest year they've had for gift card purchases because people don't want to go wrong and people hate going back to return things, so give them a gift card. Other than that, for women, I would say personalized jewelry is so big. Really dainty, delicate, everyday, affordable luxury pieces. That's wonderful, from like Dana Rebecca or Monica Vinader.
So affordable luxury. That's
affordable
a particular
luxury.
Category.
Yes.
It's not cheapo, and it's not super
No,
crazy.
You're still getting semi-precious and precious stones. So you're still seeing diamonds and rubies and emeralds and all that and gold. But it's done in such small, tasteful quantities that you can actually invest in it and wear it every day and it looks fabulous, but it might have set you back $300 as opposed to $3,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a difference.
Oh, yeah.
And I understand that travel stuff is very big.
Travel stuff is really big, and that placed into a couple of things. So experience and experiential shopping is really huge. So what people are doing is that they're really investing in, okay, I'm going to give you a gift card to a great restaurant, or I'm going to buy you a small batch whiskey, or I'm going to give you something that shows travel. So whether it's very literal and it's a clutch that has, you know, the Eiffel Tower on it, which is really big, or if it's something a little bit more abstract where it's a great pillow that came from Turkey. It's all travel-inspired pieces, things that sort of denote this worldly view. And that trickles into the actual retail experience. What retailers are realizing is that people won't come, I mean, people come into the stores, but they won't stay in the stores unless there's some element of experience to it. So as you're shopping, maybe you're just buying a basic cashmere sweater, but there might be a mini cocktail party going on, or there might be a piano playing, or there might be a fashion show. Experience is really huge for the customer. So retailers have to deliver in both product and in platform.
That's wild because, you know, we also talk about giving people experience. experiences rather than stuff.
Completely.
You know, you go out to this restaurant, you know, have a great time at this concert or something
exactly.
like that. And the retailers are picking up on that too. Even the act of shopping.
The act of shopping now has to become an experience. Uh-huh. And that's why one of the big things that will always be a huge buy for the holiday season as of, you know, the last 5 years is tech. And so what you see is, you know, for teens, for example, fancy headphones are a really big gift. And that's because they love the experience of listening to music at its highest quality. So experience
but
is
the
very
phones themselves, the you phones know, the themselves. Cans, as we call them in the radio business, are a fashion statement.
Yes. Oh, completely.
They come in all these colors.
Yes. And that plays into the travel as well. So you think about all of these elements, whether it's an actual phone or the headphones or a cashmere scarf, all of it plays into a life on the go and going places beyond your hometown.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much the same for men and for women in terms of this travel stuff?
Yes, definitely. And I think that also plays into the food items that are very big. So, like I said, small batch whiskey is a huge holiday draw, and that can be for men and women. And chocolates are always a really big thing. But now what you're seeing is chocolate infused with liquor and all of these kinds of interesting combinations. And just small curated food items. Curated marshmallows, like artisanal marshmallows, are huge. And that makes sense because it's really.
Who knew? Artisanal marshmallows.
Who
artisanal?
Wakes up and
it ain't
like,
just for cheese anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, right. How do I make that amazing marshmallow? Exactly. So, you know, they realize that you're not going to go out yourself and pay $20 for 7 marshmallows, but it's a great gift. It's a great affordable luxury. That's really the order of the day.
All right. Well, what is it? 14 more days left of shopping before Christmas. All right, Zoe, good to see you. Happy holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Zoe Washington Sheff is a fashion editor and creative consultant for leading fashion magazines, the founder of Little Bird, a fashion consulting company focusing on the teen market. We've got more information about Zoe and Little Bird on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.